If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. Three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Start some trouble and call the Fan. 888-808-1019. Powered by Paramount Plus. Stream the NFL on CBS live on Paramount Plus.
BT and Sal back on the Fan. A special treat every Wednesday throughout the rest of the season. We're going to have Howie Rose at 11 o'clock. He joins us right now, of course. Yeah. Legendary voice of the Mets. I myself grew up watching him on Sports Channel with Fran Healy. I've told Howie this before. I loved you. Grew up. I actually wrote him a letter, BT.
You told me.
Yeah. So all that stuff. Howie knows. Don't need to go into that. But Howie Rose joins us. Welcome aboard, Howie.
Hey, guys. Nice to be with you.
How about those Mets? I mean, it's been a fun run this year out of nowhere. 17 games to go. How are you feeling about the playoff chances this year based on everything you've seen up close and in person?
It's crazy. Any one of these teams in the mix can get in, and any one of the teams that get in can win it all. I mean, I think there's that much parity. I look around Major League Baseball. I don't see a superpower. And so the mantra, just get in, I think is stronger now than it's ever been.
What do you think the key is here, Howie, for this team? It's been the thing that I love about it. It's been a different player or a different aspect of the team every single night throughout the course of the year. 17 to go. We know where they stand. They get the Phillies. They get the Braves there as well before going on into the postseason. What do you think the biggest key is for this team to get in? What has to happen for the Mets to get in the playoff spot?
Well, I certainly think for any team, the key is health, because we know who and what they are right now. So I think with the Mets, well, the one thing you want to hopefully be able to maintain, and last night would be considered the exception as to the recent rule, is the length that they've gotten from their starting pitchers. Again, Peterson last night being kind of the outlier among the recent performances, he and Manaea, who goes today, and Severino have consistently been giving them 6-7 innings and taking the strain off of a bullpen that clearly had been overworked over the first third of the season. And there'd been so much flux is the right word, in the bullpen too, that what I think has been encouraging is how the roles have stabilized out there and nobody's being asked other than on, and again, this gets back to the starting pitching, the occasional basis to having to perform too much of a workload. So, for example, if you throw Buto even one inning, you've got to give him the next day off. But between Stanek and Maton, you've got guys who can go back-to-back and give you credible performances. So I think they've established some depth and reasonable reliability out there, and that is such a big factor when you get towards the postseason.
Now, Howie, I didn't write you a letter, but I've always been a fan and an admirer. I think you do an awesome job on the radio. We're looking forward to it. Hopefully, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean that. I think you're as good as it gets. So,
well, I appreciate that.
It's all good. We're wrapped up in the now, understandably, with the pennant race here. Can you take us back, though? I want to get a sense of what, not even if you didn't fully project this on the air, inwardly, Mets are 11 games under 500, and anytime, me doing St. John's, I'm like, all right, they could be this year, or they could be that. Like, you kind of have a sense of what they might do. When the Mets were just languishing, and they just looked almost unprofessional, did you think that this was even remotely possible?
Not to this extent. I had penciled them in going into the season as an 80 to 85. Four-ish win team, and I'd always said, based on the last couple of years, that if you hover around 500, you're in the conversation. So when we were, say, around the 1st of June, I don't think any of us projected, and this doesn't only include the Mets. We're talking about teams like Arizona and San Diego, who I think have been underachieving to an extent. Remember, the Diamondbacks had won the pennant last year, but I don't think anybody expected that it might have taken 90 wins to get the third wild card. We might be looking at that number right now. I thought it would be more along the lines of 86 to 88, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And that didn't seem quite plausible for the Mets as late as the end of May. But I think a couple of things happened, and one of the most significant, and it certainly wasn't understated because of the OMG and everything else, but you know, when Jose Iglesias came up, and you'll remember that they broke camp with Zach Short and Joey Wendell, as utility infielders, and it wasn't long before they determined that wasn't enough. And so the questions they had about Iglesias' range and ability to defend at the major league level were basically shrugged off. They brought him up here, and I'll never forget the first, I think it might have been his debut, and maybe he had been in one game prior to that. But anyway, late May, they're trailing, I believe, 10-3 against Arizona at Citi Field, two out in the ninth inning, and he beats out a routine ground ball to shortstop. I mean, the game's over, right? Anybody else is probably out at first base by half a step at the least. He beats that thing out, and that's a bit of a wake-up call. Now they go on to score a couple of more runs. They lose the game, but he gave them a jolt of energy that I don't think anybody had a right to expect. And obviously, you know, he went on to hit at a level that none of us saw happening. When they moved Francisco Lindor to the leadoff spot, he took off. And that was certainly a catalytic agent in moving them to where they are right now. I think those are the two big things that I look at that we couldn't have necessarily foreseen at the end of May that are big reasons for where they are right now.
BT and Sal, we're talking with Howie Rose. Pleasure to be joined by Howie every Wednesday, 11 a.m. throughout the course of the rest of the season here. You mentioned Lindor, Howie. Where does he rank? You've seen it all as far as the Mets go. Where does Lindor rank as far as the greatest Mets position players that you've seen?
In terms of this regular season or as an overall?
Oh, that's a great point, actually. Yeah, there are two parts to it. I was thinking more overall. Like, when all's said and done, it's hard for me to believe this now, but after the year he's had, Lindor's likely going to have his number retired, and he's going to be a Hall of Famer, which is crazy. So overall, as opposed to just this individual season.
You know what? We may be getting a little ahead of ourselves with that. You know, he's 30. Let's see how the rest of the career progresses. And it's been anything but a linear path to this point as a Met. But I think where he's come from where he was his first year in 2020 is remarkable. Clearly, he's a sensitive kid that, by his own admission, was trying too hard to justify the contract and was affected by the booing that he heard that first year, certainly the first month or 6 weeks of that first year in particular. He's grown from that. He's grown into the experience of not only playing in New York, but being a leader in New York and an important part of a contending team. And so I think, you know, if you look at the, quote, pantheon of best position players in Mets history, maybe he's top 10. And I wouldn't want to sit here and start counting 1 to 10 right now because in the spur of the moment, you either forget people or overstate things. But I'm still going to pull back on that a little bit until we see a little more.
I think that's the prudent move there, Howie. Yeah, I would agree. My partner's getting a little giddy. Yeah, he's right. Pushing this thing a little forward.
I do overreact. I have a tendency to overreact. That's why I want to ask Howie. He would know. I respect Howie's opinion on it.
All good. You know what's amazing? Talking about, you know, top 10 or pantheon, the Mets, and I know there's obviously examples to the contrary here, Howie and Sal, but usually Met position prospects are hyped, they come up, and they flounder. The Anthos is kind of the opposite. Like, you look at the four players that were getting all the attention for a while, and he was kind of generally lumped in. Vientos fourth, whatever. Doesn't really have a position. He's a DH at age 22. Like, he's had an amazing season, and the way he hits, his intelligence, his anticipation, his ability to adjust. This is not a charade. I think that Vientos is going to be a middle of the order stud for a while. What are you saying?
Well, first off, what encourages me the most about that possibility is that he has been largely slump-proof over a long period of time. And very often a young hitter like that starts to be recognized around the league, and inevitably the pitchers make adjustments, and then it's on the hitter to counter-adjust. And to whatever extent that's happened, he's avoided any kind of a big pitfall. That's encouraging in and of itself. But I think you have to take it a few years back. When Vientos was on his way through the system, from what I've heard, from people within the system at the time, he wasn't considered the hardest worker necessarily. He'd always had offensive ability. And I think he always felt that his bat would play regardless of where his defense wound up. But when Brett Beatty was called up a couple of years ago for the first time, for Vientos, that was a wake-up call. Tim Tuffle was in the Mets organization then as a roving infield instructor. And when Beatty was called up, Vientos got on the phone. He called Tim Tuffle and said, hey, can you meet me for some extra work tomorrow, next week, whenever it was? And that was a wake-up call, I think, for Mark, that Beatty got the call, and I think the word circulating through the Mets system was that Vientos, A, needed to work harder and needed to improve defensively. And those things went hand in hand. So there was a little bit of a growth period just right there because he saw Beatty recalled. And between that and the amount that he's worked this year, whether with Mike Sarbaugh or even with Lindor and on his own, knowing that he had the opportunity to do what he's done to this point, you know, I think is the simple maturation of a player who may have actually already overshot the expectations from within the system. Because I go back a couple of years, I'm trying to remember now, I guess it would have been the 2021 season, when they were hovering around contention. And you guys might remember that there was some thought that the Mets were going to pursue David Robertson to help out in the bullpen. He was with the Cubs then. And I had heard, however true or untrue this might be, these are things you start to hear, I'd heard that however interested the Mets were in Robertson, the Cubs wanted Vientos, and the Mets said, no, we're holding on to him. We think he's got a future here, even if he wasn't heralded among, you know, the bigger prospects in the organization, certainly not a can't-miss prospect. So they, and again, it's a different administration now, right, because the whole front office changed, but apparently there was a decision made a few years ago that Vientos had a future here if he'd work on the things that I just mentioned. And that's all worked out beautifully. And Mark is such a good kid. He's humble. He's proud. He's not taking anything for granted here. And he just continues to get better. And I love seeing that from a young player.
That's
he's been a treat to watch.
Pardon me, Howard. That's awesome. And that's why we have you on, Howie Rose, BT and Sal. A few other things we want to jump into. Real quick, though, whether it's 2, 3, 4 years, whenever he fully matures as a hitter, personally, do you think he's in the 2 spot, 3, 4, 5? Where do you see him ultimately?
Vientos?
Yep.
I think some of that depends on what the makeup of the roster is beyond this year. There's a lot of flux here. I think that there are people here who are going to be at a bit of a crossroads going into next year. We don't even know, for example, if Pete Alonso is going to be here. We know that Brandon Nimmo will be, but where does he factor in? He's hit, obviously, in the leadoff spot, but had settled into a two role. He's hit cleanup on a handful of occasions. I don't see that happening. I think that two-hitter role is in somewhat of a flux, but Mark's responded well. And the way that position, the two-hole, is looked at now as opposed to 10, 15, 20 years ago, he might be a little bit more of the modern prototype two-hitter than the old hit it the other way and move the runner over model, you know?
Yeah.
So I could certainly see him settling into that, but I think a lot of that depends on what the roster looks like next year and beyond.
Yeah, and also where Soto wants to hit once
he gets the money. Been saying this for months, Howie. Yeah, Soto's coming to Queens. That's what he says.
Howie, you mentioned Pete Alonso. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on not only Alonso's season. The word I would use to describe it was non-impactful. I know he's got 31 homers, but you're just missing that impact. Be curious your thoughts on not only Alonso's season, but what you would do with him moving forward?
Well, I think we all expected more to this point, and I think Pete expected more, and only he can answer whether he's been pressing under the strain of knowing that he's in his walk year and how many millions and millions of dollars are potentially on the table. He's the only guy that can really respond to that, but you look at it and you say, well, it's an easy statement to make, but yeah, maybe it's gotten to him a little bit, and you keep hoping, going back weeks and weeks, well, we got 2 months left, we got 6 weeks left, we got a month left, well, we're down to 2.5 weeks, and he's still capable of going on the kind of tear that most power hitters do that could carry a team right to where they need to go, but it is getting kind of late. And so what he's also got to do is impress upon this administration, who did not draft him, who did not sign him, that he's worthy of the kind of deal that he's going to seek. My feeling personally is that I think that when you take everything into consideration, as front offices do.
If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. 3-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
He's going to be 30 years old when his next contract begins. They have all of this analytic information now, biomechanical and whatnot, that inform you what a player, based on his body type, his injury history, his batting stance, his propensity for either chasing, laying off, sir, how he responds to everything. They've got all of the data necessary to project and inform what this player is going to look like in year two, year four, year five, year six of a multi-year contract. I'm not sure at age 30 that that's where this organization wants to go. That's a question that obviously will be answered in the offseason. My guess, if you're pinning me to the wall for one, is that they might make him, say, a three-year offer for whatever the money. It could be exorbitant and probably would have to be. Again, having hired Scott Boras as his agent and looking for the big hit, I mean, he's going to be 30, right? This is his one real opportunity to make the big hit. I'm not sure that would be enough, but I'm not sure what would be on the table elsewhere, too. It's kind of fascinating when you consider how the fan base has loved Pete for these 6 years now, and how if he's back, he'll probably break Daryl Strawberry's club record for home runs next year. I would like to see that happen. I just don't know if the numbers are going to work.
Yeah, I mean, Howie, I've been saying this, and they, you know, they want to stone me in public, Met fans, and Howie Rose says it. They're probably, Howie's right. I've been saying
Howie. No offense, BT, but it is Howie Rose.
It is Howie Rose. Yeah. It is for sure.
You got to remember something. This is my opinion. I don't know anything.
Right.
I mean, they could very easily come back and make him the kind of offer that keeps him here beyond, say, the 3 years that I hypothesized. That's just my feel for the situation.
And I think that your feel is going to be spot on. If it even gets that far, it could be a little less than that, depending upon how things finish up this year. But see, what I think is really complicated is value is, yeah, he's had a down year this year based on his standards. We all know that. But I think it's compounded, and this would worry me more long term, is that it's not an anomaly now with two down years with a batting average. Like, if last year, what was it, 217 or whatever he finished at last year, if last year was more in the 260 neighborhood, or 265, which it was for a couple of years, you can maybe justify and say, well, maybe the pressure, he internalized it, it was a problem. That's not really the real Pete Alonso. 2 years in a row down batting average, that's kind of becoming the real Pete Alonso.
I don't think that's unfair. I know that batting average is discounted, from what it was when we were cutting our teeth as baseball fans. I'm not sure I agree with that anyway. Mm-hmm. I think there's just this overabundance of statistical forces that sometimes make you scratch your head and go, "Oh, wait a minute, there's still nothing wrong with a 300 hitter." But Pete's never been a 300 hitter. That's not who he is. That's in all likelihood something he won't be. But they've just got to measure, as I said before, based on a number of different criterion, whether it's going to be worth the contract that he is potentially going to seek. And also, when you look at the comps, he's not Freddie Freeman. Goldschmidt got a great deal back in the day. He has not aged well. I mean, he's really getting near the end now. Obviously, he's, quite a few years older than Pete. In fact, Goldschmidt was sort of Pete's idol and prototype for what Pete's wanted to become as a first baseman. And you know what? And I give Pete a lot of credit because, all through the system we heard he was going to be a terrible liability defensively. And I remember the first year Terry Collins was just basically roving and doing a little scouting for the Mets after he stopped managing. I remember Terry coming back after watching Alonso and going, he's not that bad. I mean, he's not what they kind of led us to believe he was. And he's worked hard to make himself even better than that. He is serviceable defensively. Gold Glover, no. But again, that's just one facet of what they will consider when they look at what projects as the long-term Pete Alonso. And as I mentioned, Freeman got his, Goldschmidt got his. They are supposedly de-emphasizing big contracts for first basemen. I'm not quite sure why, but the generic they, think that's not going to help Pete's cause very much. We'll see. But I kind of stand where I've already stated that I think the Mets offer will probably be more for big money short-term than a real long-term deal.
And it will be fascinating to see how that plays out. We appreciate your time, Howie. I do want to get to a couple of things, though, before we let you go. It was a sad week, of course, with the passing of Ed Cranepool. What did Ed Cranepool mean to you and just overall Met fans who grew up watching him being a lifelong Met?
It's just as Ron Swoboda said, you know, he was Mr. Met. And I think back to the very first pennant race game the Mets ever played in 1969. It wasn't in September. It was in July of 69. And they had made their breakthrough. They'd had an 11-game winning streak late May into June. And for the first time since being born in 1962, they were, at least at midseason, contenders. So you can only imagine what Shea Stadium was like that afternoon when they faced the Cubs in the first of a three-game series, five games behind first-place Chicago in the standings. Well, Ferguson Jenkins, a future Hall of Famer, has them no-hit through the first four. The game is scoreless. Who gets the first hit for the Mets? Eddie, a home run. They're ahead 1-0. They ultimately fall behind 3-1, going to the ninth inning. They tie the game, and who gets the hit to win the game for the Mets against Jenkins but Ed Cranepool? I mean, it was so poetically perfect that the guy who'd been there, even though it was only a cameo in 1962, win the first big game they ever played. And if you ever get a chance to watch the film or the tape of Eddie's home run in the 1969 World Series, it was an add-on run. They were on their way to winning the game 5-0. I think that made it 5-0, in fact. But you could see him running the bases with this huge smile on his face all the way around the bases. And he's told me that while he was running the bases, he thought about who they were, where they'd come from, and just what that meant to him. And I think that encapsulates who he was. He was as proud a Met as there's ever been. But more importantly, he's a guy who had significant health and physical challenges through the latter years of his life. You know about the kidney transplant, which was 5 years ago. He had diabetes, which took a terrible toll on him, having surgeries on both feet that left him in a position where it became very difficult just to walk. But yet there he was. He'd be at the ballpark now and then. Whenever I'd see him, whether it was socially or at the ballpark, smiling, never complaining, loved to talk baseball, and just, you know, embraced his life despite the challenges. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And this has just been one lousy year for the Mets, having lost four members now of the 1969 World Champions in, relatively speaking, a very short time.
Yeah, yeah, and he's one of us, you know, like Liam Bazzilli from Brooklyn, Ed's from here. Yeah, it does make it a little more special and bittersweet for sure. Howie, last thing. So, and we'll work up to the Piazza home run call. 9/11, we tried to get back, and we did get off the mat, but it was hard. How did you strike the balance of incorporating just the reality of what we were facing, the human element, and then actually trying to do your job at the same time? How tough was that?
Oh, you got a minute? Because yeah, it's kind of a convoluted story. But before that game on September 21st of 2001, remember now, it was not only the first baseball game in New York since the attacks, but it was the first time that we were going to have a public gathering of anywhere between 40 and 50,000. So for a lot of us who were going to be at the ballpark that night, we were not lacking for some degree of trepidation. I know on my way to the ballpark, I was nervous. I was not thrilled about going into a building with that many people when we were all shaken to the core as we'd been 10 days earlier, almost waiting for another shoe to drop. I mean, the amount of nervousness and paranoia that engulfed us all is kind of hard to understand if you weren't of age 23 years ago. So that was the backdrop to the game. And then when I got there, I was doing TV that night with Fran Healy, and I think Ralph was at the game too, Ralph Kiner, and the executives from the Madison Square Garden Network, who oversaw the production of the game, came into the booth and told us beforehand that this was going to be unlike any game we'd ever done before, and that we could not, and this was at their insistence, we could not emote the way we normally would. So, you know, if you feel the urge to get really excited over a great play or a big hit, it might not reflect the mood of the people because everybody is still so scarred. The wound is still fresh. So you got to kind of keep everything muted and understated. And whatever you do, and this is funny because of how it played out later, but they said, whatever you do, don't make any references to things that people will be sensitive to. No mention of bombs, explosions, things that sometimes creep into the baseball vernacular. Not tonight. We don't want any of that. Okay, they left the booth, and I'm thinking, well, this is going to be kind of challenging because I don't know how the crowd's going to react at any given moment, right? I mean, It's still a spontaneous event. So now you fast forward to the bottom of the eighth inning. Piazza hits the home run, and I'm going, this one has a chance, when it was clearly on its way over the Whitestone Bridge. I mean, off the bat. That thing was a home run, But I couldn't start yelling and screaming, it's gone, it's gone. I kind of had to, as per instructions, keep it low-key and mute it as best I could. And then the instincts of a broadcaster take over, especially on television. At that moment, once that ball clears the wall, you let the pictures do the talking. But the corollary to the whole thing is that Fran Healy, who was on that call with me, had a very contentious relationship for a lot of reasons that I won't get into with those executives at MSG. He loved tweaking them. They loved going after him. It was not a pleasant thing to be involved with, even on the periphery. So if you listen long enough behind however they generally clip that call, after Piazza gets back to the dugout, Healy goes, in defiance of what they had told us, he goes, this place has been waiting to explode, and it just exploded.
Oh, wow.
Insinuating that word as defiantly as you could. And I'm just shaking my head, grinning, thinking, this crazy SOB. I mean, with everything going on, he's got to create just another layer of potential animus between himself and the executives. But he didn't care, and they did, and I was just trying to stay out of it.
That is a great story and well worth the time here. Howie, we appreciate it so much. I know we took a lot of your time up today. We appreciate it. Look forward to having you on every Wednesday here throughout the course of the rest of the season. Thank you.
My pleasure, guys. Be well.
That's awesome. I loved Howie and Fran Healy on those games.
I always liked Fran.
Me too.
And I always loved Howie.
You know what? We should get it, Fran, on, because people are like, oh, Fran Healy, you like Fran. Yes, I did.
He got knocked around a lot. I never understood it. I always liked the guy.
Here are the lone two media members that love Fran Healy, or at least, on the radio. Let's get him on. Talk some baseball with Fran Healy one of these days.
Yeah, man. I don't have to do that.
Come on. I want to relive those moments. Howie just told a great story. I'd like to get now Fran's side of it. Yeah. Hey, Fran, what was the bickering between
them? Think about how tough that would have been for Howie. I mean, because, Fran could at least react as the color guy.
Yeah.
You're Howie. You get these directives here, which I understand from MSG at that point. Hey, try to strike the proper tone. Right. Somber versus compassion versus a little energy if something presents itself. I mean, he must have been inside his head, Howie, that night to the point where
he
must have been paralyzing trying to call that game.
Right. You could relate, right, as a broadcaster.
Sure. Well, not as a play-by-play,
as a broadcaster,
extent.
Though, just hearing him say the bosses come in, hey, before you do this, you can't do this, you can't do that, keep it down. And I never knew the story of this ball has a chance, but that, to me, I love that part of the call because it does, you could hear it in his voice, even though he didn't say, it's out of here, long gone, whatever.
Yeah.
He gave you this ball has a chance with the great excitement and anticipation. It gives me goosebumps.
It's great.
Hearing him tell the story and even thinking about it. We'll play that call here as we go to break. I just want to get this read in, BT. We'll come back, take some calls as well. We have 3RQ coming up. We have Susan Waldman next hour. Packed show here today, 888-808-1019. Contractors, get what you need to get the job done. Head to Windorama. They keep a huge supply of Anderson windows, patio doors, and storm doors in many sizes in stock at their distribution center for pickup or quick delivery. Windorama is proud to feature Anderson, the number one trusted window and door brand. Plus, get access to other premium brands. Call Windorama at 1-800-695-RAMA. Visit one of their 25 showrooms throughout the tri-state area or Windorama.com and let your project be their passion. Let's listen to Howie Rose on that call on that special day, the day, the game after 9/11, 9/21/01, the Piazza home run.
Lopez wants it away.
And it's a deep to left center. Andrew Jones on the run. This one has a chance. Home run by Piazza. And the Mets lead 3-2.
If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. Three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.